is a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
jumping back into the science chair on a Thursday morning is Dr. Carl, fresh from hanging out with his buddies at NASA. And you told us last week when you called up from America that you made it almost to the launch of one of the final space shuttle launches in Cape Canaveral in Florida. You were literally in the plane and watching the rocket take off through the clouds as you were coming down to land.
It was amazing. I was ever so lucky. Then after that, every day I'd go out and then into the VAB, the Vertical Assembly Building, and see them do things to it and put it all together. And the thing with the building is that it was it's such a big building. The NASA building. It's the biggest single-story building in the world. It's so big that it's got a floor area roughly three times pick any Australian major cricket field in Australia, the Wacker, the Gabba, the Melbourne Cricket Ground, the Sydney Showground. And it's big enough to take the tallest skyscraper.
That's right,
in that city.
Saying.
And it has its own weather. And it's just landed now. And it's just happy. And in fact, you can buy one.
A rocket?
Yeah, no, the space shuttle. The price is, according to the article in New York Times, condition, 27 years old, 150 million miles travelled, a bit dinged but well maintained. Price is zero, but the dealer preparation and transport charges, $28.8 million.
Oh, that's all right.
So there's three of them left, so people are trying to get them for their museums around the place. And the thing is that the tiles, you think of a tile as being a tile. Mate, it's got the structural integrity of wet tissue paper.
Mm.
I bought one. You put it in your hand and you can crumble it. And that's why they can't clean it, because the act of touching it destroys it. So either you chip the whole thing off and put it and stick on another one with glue, or you just let it look dirty. You can't scrub it clean. And yet it can take 3,000 degrees. And that's the only barrier between the extreme heat of the re-entry and the aluminium thing. So it's just an aluminium plane coated with this incredibly light space shuttle tile.
Wow. It sounded like you had a very good time over there, Dr.
Oh, I was in heaven. And I even got to drive on possibly the most sophisticated machine known to the human race, the Segway.
Oh,
and I look like
you're driving a Segway.
Yeah.
See, that's more impressive to me than you seeing a shuttle.
Oh, well, I tell you, for the first 5 minutes, you're sort of thinking, oh, I'm a bit nervous. And the next 10 minutes, you're thinking, oh, this is cool. And for the next hour, you don't even know it's there. You want to go?
You're just being carried along by. Standing on a platform that's got wheels on it.
Yeah, if you want to go faster, you just lean forward. If you want to slow down, you lean back. And you want to turn, you lean. And you just want to stand there, you just stand there. And if somebody else talks, you just wheel around to them automatically. And we went to the beach where Kelly Slater, the surfing guy, did all of his practice. And I'm looking at this beach at Cocoa Beach, and there's these little waves, and underneath there's a little plaque that says where he practiced all his teenage years on these small but challenging waves. So they may be 30 centimetres high, 40 centimetres high, half a metre. They go 10 metres and they stop. So you can, it's perfect for a learner, and they've got enough substance in them that you can just keep on learning over and over again.
Lots and lots of tales inside your head, Dr. Carl, sharing with us today here as we talk science. If you've got a question for us, Dr. Carl is here to answer them for you. Give us a buzz, 1-300-055-36. If you've got any answers and you can't get through, you can tweet Dr. Carl on if you're on Twitter, DOCTORKARL, or text us in any comments or answers on 1975-7555. Let's go to Stephanie on the Sunshine Coast. Good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Great. What's your question?
My question is about grinding my teeth in my sleep. My husband says that I do it all the time and it's really loud. And then when I try to do it the next day to see, like, if I can do it as loud, it's, like, not even possible. And I'm just wondering how much damage this is doing to my teeth and how it happens.
Do you have a sore jaw in the daytime or have problems
sometimes
with clicking of your jaw?
No, it doesn't click, but sometimes it's sore a little bit, but...
Okay, I've had that problem, and it's called bruxism, B-R-U-X-I-S-M. Look it up in Wikipedia. And it can, after many years, damage your teeth. In fact, the day after my father died, the next morning, I woke up and all my teeth were loose in my head. I could actually get my teeth and wobble them with my finger.
Wow.
Because they're not
really
bolted onto the bone. They're sort of hung in ligaments. And it's probably worthwhile seeing your dentist. He'll pass you on to the appropriate sort of specialist who'll just adjust things or get you to wear a little splint in your teeth so you don't damage it, because I end up having a bit of pain, the TMJ, temporomandibular joint syndrome. See a dentist about it. It's often due to stress. See a dentist.
Okay, Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Stephanie.
Thanks for the call, Stephanie.
Thank you.
See you later. Tommy's on the line from Brisbane. Hi, Tommy.
Oh, good morning.
Hi, Dr. Tommy. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carl. I just had a question about personality. I guess I just wondered if it's sort of been isolated or how much science knows about sort of where it sort of comes from in the brain or whether it can be adjusted.
We do know some things, but we do definitely are very shallow. If you think of the knowledge that we need being the size of the Pacific Ocean, we might have dipped our feet in the sand, in the water. We know very little about the scientific basis of personality. The psychologists are doing great work, but we still haven't been able to bring it down to the atomic, molecular, chemical, central nervous system, hormonal level. We know so little about it. However, there is a Centre for Unexplained Diseases in the NIH, National Institute of Health in the United States, and there was a case of a woman, I was just reading about this, who had a disease. Well, she had her problem was that she lived in New York and she couldn't walk. So I can't answer your question. So I'm answering something I can't answer. So she couldn't. She could walk downtown, but she couldn't walk back uptown. She was just getting weaker, and there were these growths of calcium on her skin. And the doctor looked at her and then had a look at her five sisters, and they had this same thing happening. And so once they'd done a full medical workup and had no idea what was going on, they passed them on to this mob in the National Institute of Health, who then said, this is probably something genetic. You've got 3 million base pairs in your DNA, 3,000 million. They randomly looked at 1 million of them, and they struck the jackpot. And it turns out that the cells on your skin and in your blood vessels make calcium all the time in all of us. And, they didn't know this before, and you have a gene that switches it off or moderates it down. And these five women didn't have that gene. So on something as obvious as growing lumps of calcium on your skin, we've only discovered, we just have found out just now, whereas something difficult like the personality, much too hard.
Thanks for the call, Tommy.
Thank you, Dr. Tommy.
Thanks anyway. Bye.
See you later. We're going to stick around in Brisbane with Dave. Hi, Dave, where are you?
Good morning, guys. I just got a work site.
Oh, right. Okay, what's your question?
I got an email the other day saying that the volcanoes in Iceland spewed out more CO2, and it pretty much put all our green solutions and green efforts for the last year, it was wasted, sort of thing.
That's a lie that's going around. If you go to the ABC Science homepage, and there's a wonderful episode of The Science Show with Robin Williams, and there's a lecture there by a woman called Nancy Oreskes. You can download it and read the transcript, or you can listen to it. And what she says is that the same people who were paid by Big Tobacco to deny that tobacco caused any problems with health, the George C. Marshall Institute, are the same people who are being funded by Big Energy. And with regard to your specific question, in a big volcano year, the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases given out by all the volcanoes in a big carbon year are less than 1/100 of 1% of human emissions, as opposed to one volcano put out more than the whole world. But the thing is, if a lie is big enough and you say it often enough, people will believe it. So they're lying to you, Dr.
A lot of propaganda.
Yeah.
No worries. I was just interested because I'm like, that's the first kind of thing that's made me think about, is this all worth it, being green and whatnot, like that.
It will be worth it.
It was a pretty good lie.
Yeah, look, it will be worth it. If you go to getting all of our electricity from renewables, we can have it in 10 years from now, and it will supply electricity to you and me at 1/3 of the cost of burning coal. Not more expensive, but 1/3 the cost. Go to my homepage, drcarl.com, and look up Zero Carbon Australia. It'll blow your mind.
Thanks for the call, Dave.
Thank you, guys.
See you later. Dr. Carl's joining us till midday today. We're talking science. Give us a buzz, 1-300-055-536. I can see one line free right now. Zan here with you on a Thursday morning. Dr. Carl joining us after a couple of weeks, well, a week and a little bit, out in Cape Canaveral in Florida, watching one of the final space shuttles launch. But he is back and all yours and answering your science questions this morning. Give us a buzz, 1-300-055-536 with your questions, like Jeremy in Canberra. Hi, Jeremy.
G'day, doctors.
What's your question?
Well, I was watching something on Nat Geo last night, Richard Hammond's World of the Invisible or something like that, and they were talking about cavitation. And it's like a boat propeller, when it's going fast enough, will vaporize the water and turn it to air, which propels the boat. And so I was thinking, will if you actually preheated a propeller, will it increase the instance of cavitation and like make the boat go faster?
The cavitation is not what makes the boat go faster. In fact, it slows the boat down.
Okay.
Now, imagine you've got a blade and you just go straight through the water in a straight line. Well, it cuts through the water really well. But imagine you've got the blade at a bit of an angle. Well, then you have to push hard to go through the water.
So obviously more drag. Yep.
Yeah. So if you then hook a motor onto it and spin that blade, you can arrange it so that as it cuts through the water, it pushes the water out the back. And then if the water's going in one way, Newton's third law of action reaction, you get the boat going in the other direction. Now, you can have a pressure, a region of lower pressure behind the blade. And then when the pressure drops low enough, the water will boil. Like when we were in the Himalayas, we were boiling water and it only got up to 80 degrees centigrade. You could cook it all day. The pasta wouldn't cook, right? So if you drop the pressure enough, the water will boil at, say, 20 degrees centigrade. And when water boils, it turns from water, a liquid, into a gas. It increases in volume by 1,700 times, and you get this pressure wave, and it can eat through the propeller blade. And this is a really nasty thing. So if you're increasing the temperature, you're making it more likely to cavitate and more likely to destroy the blade. And people are spending millions upon millions of dollars to improve the efficiency of blades. And at one stage, the Americans had this special blade that they had on submarines, and they were using Toshiba milling machines to make the blade, and then Toshiba in Japan sold the technology to the Russians, and the Americans were ever so upset. So look, the cavitation is a big, big thing.
Okay.
Thanks for the call,
Jeremy.
Thank you, Jeremy.
No worries,
Jeremy. And for making me understand, or a little bit understand, what cavitation was. I'd never heard of that before.
Oh, anybody with a big V8 does.
Dave's on the line from Newcastle. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you going?
Great. What's your question?
G'day, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Dave, welcome.
Yeah, mate, now, I'm just wondering, I've always had a problem with my ears. When, you know, when you go up in an aeroplane and your ears pop?
Yep.
And you have to blow out to make your ears okay so that anyone can hit, so you can hear anybody.
Yep.
Basically, I've always had the opposite problem where I've, on normal ground, anywhere I am, I have to actually suck my ears in to actually hear people, to actually be able to focus on someone. Otherwise, there's too much going on in my ears and I can't hear anything. I'm wondering why that possibly could be.
What's going on in your ears? Are you hearing a noise, humming?
It's more just if I have my ears blocked out, I just hear everything. It's all jumbled up. Whereas if I pop my ears, I can actually hear, like I can focus on something and I can focus on what I'm listening to.
Ah, okay. Two things. The second thing is you should go to see your GP.
Yep.
To get bounced onto an ENT, ear, nose and throatologist.
Yep.
Who will then firstly look in your ear and then secondly maybe anaesthetise your nose and slide a pipe up your nose and then up the eustachian tube to try and see how far up they get to see if there's anything blocking your eustachian tube. So firstly, I'd recommend you go and see a medical doctor. And then, by the way, in Australia, we're lucky enough that because you paid taxes, you automatically get medical care via Medicare. So that's all good. And then the second thing is the problem is with the eardrum. Now, you hear a sound wave travels through the air. It gets funneled down through your slightly tapering ear canal, the external ear canal, where you should not put in a cotton bud. And this is called by the engineers impedance matching. And then when you're listening to the quietest noise you can possibly listen to, your eardrum is moving backwards and forwards a distance roughly equal, the latest figure I heard, is the diameter of a hydrogen atom. It's a very sensitive little membrane, and you can possibly have some overpressure in the system due to something with your eustachian tube, which is putting a continuous random background noise, which is blocking your easy breathing, your easily listening.
Yep.
So I think that's what I'm thinking, that you've got a permanent static pressure on your eardrum.
And, yeah, right.
Yeah, so I'll definitely go and see your Jeep.
Thanks for the call, Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carl. Thank
good luck. And I love the word eustachian. What a great word.
Ah.
Eustachian.
Oh.
Sounds good.
Oh, you've made
it's
me
like
get
a chewy
all
word. You could chew on that.
Inside.
Eustachian.
I love words. And in fact, if you look at the works of the most popular author ever, come on, now it wasn't the Bible. After the Bible, who wrote more, who sold more books than anybody else in the history of the human race?
Shakespeare or L. Ron Hubbard?
Good guess. No, Agatha Christie.
Agatha Christie?
Yeah, the detective writer. And she sold a billion books. Now, back in the 1100s, there was two monks who decided they would mark out how many words there were in the Bible and how many incidences there were of in the beginning of every word. And it took them all their life, and then they died, and then somebody else took over. Now, you can do it today in 15 minutes. And people have been doing it to Agatha Christie's books. And she's got a very rich and florid use of the English language.
Florid's also a good word.
And very fluent. and suddenly, with her 80th book, the number of new of rich words that she used dropped right down, diminished enormously. And it was because she was having a bit of Alzheimer's coming on.
Right.
And the thing is that you and I write emails all the time, and so you can then go back over the years, once we've got the technology right, and then say, oh, I think Zan had a bit of a late night. Like, all she could say was duh in her email. I'm sorry, I'm picking on you there. But thank you for using the word eustachian.
All right, Dr. Carl's joining us here at Triple J. We are talking about science and words and the science of words. And I have a great question from Chris in Pakenham on the line. Hi, Chris.
G'day, how are you?
Great. Hi. I love your question. What is it?
Oh, we've had this debate that worked for the last year now, coming into soup season, getting a bit cooler.
Soup season, my favourite season of all.
Yeah, definitely. But it raises a debate whether you eat soup or you drink soup. Is it a food or is it a drink? Now, this is going to be the end of me because it happens every lunchtime now.
Oh, dear. Well, look, blow me down. Look, there I was rapping with my bro, Hester Blumenthal, and I asked him about onions.
Yep.
And how come when you got onions, you throw a certain amount of heat into them?
Yep.
You got a certain amount of heat. If you throw it in really quickly, you end up getting burnt, crispy, delicious barbecued onions. If you do it really slowly, they go translucent. And I didn't ask him that question, and I should have done it, Chris. Okay, now, let me give you background.
Yeah.
Is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable? Is any particular thing a fruit or a vegetable? And the way you work that out is, do you add, according to my friend Paul Willis, if you add ice cream to it, it's a fruit. If you add gravy to it, it's a vegetable. Wow. With regard to soup, if you pick up the bowl and slurp it down in Japan, as you do in Japan, it's a drink. If you use a spoon and are ever so well bred, then it's a food.
Really?
I don't know.
See, I would say that...
I go both ways.
I would say that drink is something that that stops you from being dehydrated and food is something that sustains you. And I would probably look at soup as something that would sustain you because even if it's blended, it's got... you know, vitamins and fiber and, you know, various other things that possibly, you know, go beyond just rehydration.
Yeah, but then you've opened a whole can of worms. What if when I'm really
or
I've
a can
had a
of
big
soup.
Day and I've got to have my special brown bubbly medicine, which has got 5% alcohol in it to make me feel better, is that a
That's
drink
not rehydrating.
Or food? No, it's not rehydrating, but is it a food?
Because Chris, I think you've blown our minds.
It's too hard, Chris.
Look, I'd love to...
Can you just say it is a food? That would
I feel like there's there's a bet on this.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Dr. Carl, and I reckon that soup is a food.
There you go, Chris.
Booyah, thank you very much.
Take two. Hi, I'm Dr. Carl. I reckon soup is a drink. Pick one.
poor Chris. Hey, thanks for the call, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
Let us know if you think soup's a food or a drink as well. You can tweet us at Dr. Carl or text us in 1975-7555. Thank you to everybody who texted and tweeted in. By and large, everyone's saying soup is a food. Why would it be on the food part of the menu and not the drinks if it wasn't? Someone said soup's a food. If soup's a food, what's jelly? Which is a good question. Someone else tweeted in that soup's mixed media of food
mixed
and drink.
Mixed media.
So like, that's a fusion.
It's a fusion, man. I love fusion.
And
that's
if you have
I'm
to chew it, it's food, which would suggest that soup's a drink. So I don't know, like mainly everyone's saying soup's a food, but there's still a few people.
But what about in Japan where you pick up the bowl and you bring the bowl to your lips and you make a loud slurping noise to show appreciation, well, as you do in China?
When I have miso, I don't use a spoon. I drink it out of the bowl, but I still consider it soup.
Definition. We need a new word.
Clearly we haven't resolved this at all. 1300 055 36. If you've got a science question, Dr. Carl's with us till midday and answering your questions. Tara's on the line from...
She was on the line.
It's a shame too because she had a question about poo. Maybe she'll come back. We'll see if we can get her back on the line. Kane is on the line, hopefully, from Bendigo. Hi, Kane.
G'day, doctors. How you going?
Great. What's your question?
Very good. My question is, why, when bugs and insects are dropped from a great height, aren't they injured when, if we were thrown off the equivalent height, we'd be severely damaged?
Look up the term terminal, rather chilling name, velocity, terminal velocity in Wikipedia. And when you fall, please don't do this as an experiment at home, there will be two forces acting upon you. Number one, the suck of gravity, for gravity sucks. Number two, the wind resistance. In the case of a human, you get up to around 200 kilometres per hour when these forces balance. And then if you were to hit the ground, you stop suddenly, and yet the blood vessels inside your body keep moving and they get torn off, for example, the heart, and then your heart beats for a few more beats and it's just pumping blood and then it's really messy. With a cat, they are lighter and fluffier. Their terminal velocity is lower, about 100 kilometres per hour. And there's a video around how cats can survive a fall better from 32 stories than from 7 stories, because at 7 stories they still haven't wised up the fact that they're falling, but by the time they're 32 stories, they're chilled out and they're ready to drop, and they spread the force over their whole body. With an ant, with a small insect, their terminal velocity might be 10 kilometres per hour, because they've got a large surface area relative to their mass, and they just don't get it up a lot of speed. And so it's just like you jumping from a tall step. It's a bit of a jump, but no big deal.
Mm.
So they don't suddenly stop from 200 kilometres per hour like we do, but maybe 10, quite slow.
No worries, so it's just purely mass.
It's a balance of the surface area, the wind resistance, and the gravity.
Yeah.
If you had an ant that was the same size as an ant but was made of, say, osmium or osmeridium that has a density of 22, it would fall quite fast. But made of stuff like what they're made of, they fall slowly.
Thanks for the call, Kane.
Thank you, Kane.
Amy's on the line from Newcastle. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how you doing, guys?
Great.
Hi, Dr. Amy.
That's good. My question, Dr. Carl, is on emotions.
Yep.
I actually have a problem. I work in customer service, and it's not just at work. I find that when I'm connected, like if I'm serving someone in my job, if that person is upset or I become really emotional, like teary, like I can't watch things like the Olympics, I become emotional and teary, or it's not a negative, like if they're upset because it's a negative thing, or even if someone's super happy and they're emotionally happy, I then become emotional as well. I don't understand why I do that. And the only way that I can kind of stop myself from becoming teary or get that throat thing happening is to disconnect myself and kind of walk away.
Now, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you catch yawns from other people? If somebody else yawns,
yes, I do.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Look, there's a range of emotional connectedness. And it's a spectrum. And at one end, you have people who are extremely autistic and who just don't get emotions in some cases, or people who are schizophrenic, and they can't catch yawns. And then there's a spectrum, and it goes all the way up to where you are. And in my case, when I see something bad happening, I have a really painful tingling in my groinal area, which hurts.
Yeah.
And if I see somebody hitting a child or a dog, it's not just something that goes into my eyeballs and into my brain. I feel a pain in my groin. And my daughter and I, Alice, will watch a movie and weep. And the rest of the family is saying, "It's just a movie, for God's sakes, toughen up." So all I can say is you're at the end of that spectrum. Why? We don't know. But you're a really nice person and emotional, and it's hard for you probably to do bad things because you just empathise with somebody. I'll pick up the dollar that they dropped. No, I can't do it. I'll have to give it to them.
No, I couldn't do that. I'd have to tap them on the shoulder and say, "Oh, sorry, you dropped a dollar." Yeah.
Well, maybe in years to come we'll know how to make people who do bad things because they don't feel emotions, feel emotions. Maybe you could get a job as an emotion mentor and we can bleed your emotions into them. We don't understand why, but it does happen.
Good on you, Amy. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye. Darren's on the line from Wollongong. Hi, Darren.
Oh, hi there. Hi, guys.
Hi.
I've just got a question for Carl. Oh, it's probably more of an observation. It's about the flicker fusion rate, which is spoken a lot about on this program.
Mm-hmm.
I was riding my motorcycle, which is a parallel twin. You'd be familiar with those cars?
A parallel twin? twin.
A twin cylinder, like an old British bike.
Oh, like the old Trumpies and the Beezers.
Yeah, that's that style of bike.
Okay.
And they suffer from a lot of natural vibration. Anyway, I was riding the bike along, and I was looking in the mirror at the car behind me, and I could see his hubcap, and it went into that state of flicker fusion where it looked like it was stop or slowing up, you know. Anyway, I pulled the mirror wasn't shaking to look at, but when I pulled the clutch in and let the bike come back to idle, I'd still looking in the mirror, the hubcap suddenly sped up and went back to its normal rotation.
So there's a vibration going through the bike.
Yeah. But when you look at the mirror, it's not, you can't see any vibration in the mirror. It's a clear vision. But when you pull the clutch in and let the vibration, natural vibration through the bike that you can't see or feel really, let it come back to idle, then the flicker fusion rate would change in the mirror and the hubcap would speed up again.
Wow. Okay. Well, look, just a bit of background for the audience. Number one, flicker fusion rate is the rate at which you have to show a series of still pictures so they appear to be continuous. So in humans, if I show you a bunch of pictures of a car going down the road, one after the other, bang, 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 you say there's a still. And once you get up to about 15, 20, depending on the lighting, 20 individual pictures per second, they appear like a continuous stream. And with birds, you have to get up to about 70 or 80. And this depends on lighting and all sorts of other things. That's the first thing. Secondly, with regard to vibrations, I was talking to a guy who drove a biodiesel bike around Australia. Now, instead of doing the right thing and going and getting a Russian diesel bike, he got a bike that some students at a university in Australia had put together as an engineering project, and they just got this engine, diesel engine, and they shoved it into a bike. They just got a crappy single-cylinder engine that put out so much vibration that he got nerve damage to his arms and damaged some of the vertebrae in his spine and some of the discs. Poor bugger.
That's intense.
Yeah. In your case, you've got some vibration going through. And so there's some weird mix. Now, I can't give the answer on the air because it's too complicated, but I've just given the audience a hint that what they should do is if they're in a vibration situation, look around. So, for example, if you're brushing your teeth with an electric toothbrush, as I did this morning with my daughter, I had a look at the hard drive recorder and the numbers were waving up and down. So look at electronic things and reflections of moving things, you'll see weird things happening. So, Darren, there's something weird going on. I can't understand it fully. I'm not deep enough to understand it. I'll have to sit down and spend half an hour, and then between the two of us and a small beer, we could work it out.
Thanks for the call, Darren.
Thank you, Dr. Darren. But fascinating insight.
I would like to have the vibration or inner vibration situation on a T-shirt at one stage in my life, Dr.
Ooh.
Carl. We've got Dave on the line from St. Kilda. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Dr. Carl. How are you?
All right.
Good. Just a quick question. Now, I was thinking about space the other day. Now, down here on Earth, we have sea level air pressure of 14.7, if I remember correct. Now, in space, there's also gases, but we're told there's zero air pressure. Is this correct or not?
Close to zero. If you get a cubic metre of air and weigh it, it weighs about 1.24 kilograms, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's trillion, 6.02 by 10 to the 23 by how much, multiply by how many times 22.4 goes into 1,000. But there's a lot of molecules in there, 10 to the 25, 20 to the 26. In other words, 1 followed by 26 zeros, something like that. In space, near the Earth, at the level of the space station, there's not a lot of air molecules up there, but there's enough, and the space station is so big that every day it loses 0.7 of a kilometre of altitude. It's 300 kilometres up and it comes 700 metres closer to the Earth every day. And so sometimes when the spatial's up there, they've got a bit of extra fuel, they'll just fire the rockets and boost it up, or they bring up fuel to boost it up. As you go further and further into space, you end up with fewer molecules of stuff per cubic metre. But even in deep, deep vacuum between the stars, we still reckon that there's hundreds of molecules per cubic metre. So you never get down to zero.
Okay, so there's no such thing as absolute zero then?
No, hang on, absolute vacuum.
Okay.
Absolute zero is a different thing. And surprisingly, the coldest temperature we think of in the we think has been generated in the universe was generated not in space, but in a laboratory in Massachusetts somewhere. But that's a different story. But yeah, vacuums are not perfect. Nothing made by humans is perfect.
Thanks for the call,
okay.
Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Dr. Carl's with us for another 15 minutes. Got a question? Give us a buzz. You've only got a little while longer. 1-300-0555-36. We're talking science for just a little while longer. Dr. Carl sitting in the chair as he does every Thursday. Don't forget, if you've come in halfway and you're wishing you heard the first half, you can. The podcast will be up for you just after midday today, in about an hour's time or so, triplej.net.au. Just click on podcast at the top of the page and subscribe to Dr. Carl and you'll never miss any of our science talkback hours. Tara's on the line from Canberra. Hi, Tara.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. What's your question?
So I have one of those friends who makes up weird scientific hypotheses about things. One of the ones he's come up with is that 3 a.m. is the stillest part of the night in terms of, like, wind. Is there any kind of science to that, or is he just an idiot?
There is some science to that. Wind is when the air moves from one place to another. And the easiest driver of that to think of is temperature. So if you consider the coast, the water changes temperature really slowly. But the land, the soil, the dirt, the rock, changes temperature quickly. So first thing in the morning, a bit after the sun has risen, well, the water is warmish and the land is cold from the night. And so the water is warmish, the air rises above the water, and you get a nice breeze coming off the shore from the land out to sea, and it shapes the waves nicely. At the end of the day, the land has heated up, and so the air is rising above the land and is being replaced by air over the water. So the air goes from the water onto the land, and you get crap-looking waves. So depending on your local geography, you know, mountains, valleys, near the ocean, near a lake, mid-morning, pre-sunrise morning, you know, somewhere between midnight and sunrise, the temperatures are all equilibrated, and therefore the air's not rising in one place but rather another, so there's no wind. So it varies. But 3 o'clock, 2 o'clock is close enough, yeah?
Good.
Thanks for the call, Tara.
Thank you.
See you later. Evan's on the line from Rockdale. What's your question, Evan?
Hey, good morning, doctors.
Good morning,
Dr. Evan.
My question is, I just want to know if wearing a hat can cause baldness?
Yes and no. The standard answer is no, and you're just going to go bald anyway because, hey, if you haven't had your children by 22, you're over the hill, so consider yourself lucky you can even walk. You know, and as you get older, you're going to just lose your hair anyway. But I keep on reading about certain Hollywood actors who, as part of their acting training, spend hours a day brushing their hair this way and that way. Obviously, it hasn't worked for Nick Cage. But some actors, they have gloriously luxuriant hair until late on. And maybe there is something you can do about it. And maybe wearing the hat, so the hat, if it's a tight fit, stops the blood supply, maybe. But the standard teaching is no. Now, a little side issue on that. Most of us can't do anything useful with our toes. With our fingers, we can write, we can undo knots, but with our toes, we can't.
Mm.
And that's because we shove them into a shoe.
Oh, okay, because I pretty much wear a hat like every day at work for about 10 to 12 hours.
Well, you might have to protect your face from getting burnt, and that's a good thing, but maybe wearing a loose-fitting hat. But according to current knowledge, it doesn't make a big difference. And so getting back to the toes, Houdini used to go barefoot. He was a famous escapologist, and he trained himself, he could undo knots with his toes. Most of us don't try. So getting back to your skull, it could be that. So try wearing a loose-fitting hat. So, but the standard knowledge is it doesn't really make any difference, but there could be something more in it. I don't know at this stage.
Okay, very good. Thanks for the call, Evan.
Thank you, Dr. Evan.
Thanks,
bye. Is baldness caused by too much testosterone? Is that the right theory?
In some cases, yes, you have different receptors. Well, firstly, there's different receptors, testosterone receptors on the hair follicle, and there are different types of testosterone that you make during your life as you get older, T1, T2, T3, T4. And one sure way of stopping baldness in a male is castration.
Oh, good. Well, perhaps that's great.
A little bit dramatic, drastic, but still.
So you can either go bald or lose something else.
Yeah, bald. Yeah, okay, we won't go there.
That's intense. Yeah. We have Mark on the line from West Wyalong. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
G'day, guys. How are you?
Great. Welcome. What's your question?
Mine's an astronomy question. It's something I've been dabbling in for the last couple of years, and just watching documentaries and whatnot on YouTube and on TV, just some simulations of the Earth rotating around, well, all the planets rotating around the Sun. And right now, we know that the Earth is rotating around the Sun at 108,000 kilometres per hour. Is there a distance perpendicular to the Sun where you can actually see that happening. Just going by this simulation, where you can literally see this Earth spinning around the sun at an incredible speed. Is there a distance in space where you can literally see that happening?
Okay, so the Earth is orbiting. We're not talking about it spinning on its own axis or rotating, but it's orbiting.
You're orbiting the sun, yes.
It's orbiting the sun at about 30 kilometres per second. The trouble is, you don't have a background to see it against. If you could go above the north pole of the sun and rise up in space and then look down, if you had like a painted track, you could see the Earth going past that track at 30 kilometres per second. But the only reference point you would have would be the distant stars. So
right,
it'd be hard to see.
It'd be hard to see. Right,
yeah, but it's real. And look, let me congratulate you on your having astronomy as a hobby, because astronomy was the very first science. And the motto of the philosopher is, I think, therefore I am. And the motto of the astronomer is, I think, therefore I get paid.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Thank you.
Oh, he liked that one.
Oh, good.
Well, we've got time for one more very quick one from Chris in Hawthorne. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Great. What's your question?
Well, I want to know, I've been thinking about this for a while, actually. If you had, like, an imaginary scales that was holding up the planet Earth, over the last couple billion years, would the mass have increased or decreased?
It increases by roughly 30,000 tonnes per day.
Yep.
Due to meteor dust.
Oh, wow.
There's a continuous shower of meteor dust. However, there is also a continuous loss of some of the gases. Now, if the gases, they're probably on average, the molecules move at, I don't know, 800 kilometres per hour or something like that, the individual molecules, and you feel this as pressure in a balloon when you blow it up.
Yeah.
And but some of them, there's a bell-shaped curve, are moving fast enough to escape Earth, which is, I think, what, 17 or 27,000 kilometres per hour, forgotten. So there's always a continuous bleeding. I think the overall pattern is that the Earth is increasing by about 20, 30,000 tons per year of mass.
Fantastic.
Per day.
Great. Per day?
Per day, 30,000. Well, the Earth, every second, the sun burns up 600 million tons of hydrogen.
Mm.
That's a big number.
That's a
every
lot.
Every second.
Mm.
And the sun is so big it can keep on doing it for a long time. But if we live long enough, 5 billion years, you'll see the effects.
Thanks for the call, Chris.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Dr. Chris.
Oh, such a downer.
No.
Not well, Chris, you.
No, well, yeah, in 5 billion years, the Earth will increase in size until it comes out and it will encompass Mercury, then definitely Venus, maybe the Earth. So we'll just move somewhere else.
All right, well, get yourself cryogenically frozen so you can see that happening. Dr. Carl's been joining us back in the chair, as he always is, every Thursday at 11 a.m. to talk science. Don't forget, you can download the podcast a little bit after midday today. It'll be up there for you. And you'll be back next week. Dom Alessio will be sitting in the morning's chair from Monday when I head off to the South by Southwest Music Conference to cover it for Triple J. But science will still live here on mornings. So join Dom Alessio and Dr. Carl next Thursday, to talk science. Thanks, Dr. Carl.
Thank you. And I'm jealous you're going to Austin. I'm jealous.
Oh,
jealous.
Like you never get to travel.
I want to go to Austin with you.
See you next week.
I want to be your new best friend forever.